It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Soze!
No, that's Matthew Soze.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yes.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Soze.
Every single woman who meets him instantly wants to sleep with him, or they're flirting with him.
Hello there, film lovers. Are you all right over there?
Good.
You got it?
Got it now.
Can I start?
Yep.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoci@WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter, @MatthewSoci. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and we also have a blog, which we are revamping. We are in
There's cool stuff there now. There's fun stuff, funny stuff.
We have is the trailer that we're gonna the film we're gonna talk about.
Oh no, I didn't put that up.
Wow, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would have been helpful.
Where can people check out the incomplete blog?
Filmsociology.tumblr.com.
The voice you just heard is the man who didn't post the trailer for Sugar Hill.
I'll post it.
That's Kobe Slagle.
I got it.
And how's your intern?
Oh, he's good. I think he didn't know that we were about to start, so he's probably still over there at the office.
Staring at the walls.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, Kobe's summer intern is actually winding up, because...
he's got to get back to camp soon.
I know. IPS started last week, and I know HW's camp school starts next week. But Kobe's summer intern has been a Tyler Hansborough bobblehead doll. Does a lot of work.
Yeah, he does.
And so...
You have an intern?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We've been if you check out the blog at filmsociology.tumblr.com, you can check out the
You see Tyler at work.
Yeah, he was here on the board one week.
So. Confused him.
Yeah, I mean it looks complicated. There's like 20 faders here, but really they're all the same thing, just different sources, and
we're trying to teach him that.
You only use like three buttons.
he couldn't. He had difficulty with that.
Well, I was saying, if you heard
it
Tyler,
like, it was like Khan on the bridge of the Excelsior. Where's the Obadiah? The Obadiah.
Have you heard Tyler Reed? You'll understand that. So now the third voice you're hearing. Well, for you fans of AM radio, and he's now a regular here at Film Sociology. He's so much of a regular, he has his own intro.
The blackest brother in the galaxy, Nubian God.
What's a Nubian?
Will someone shut that man up?
Never! Never!
Sounds like Mr. Feeney.
The founder of IndiePolitics.org, E.K. Hornbeck, Abdul, better known as Abdulkarim Shabazz, is here. How are you?
I was going to be back here, my friend. How's everything going?
Is it time has not left?
Yeah, it's been almost a year since my first appearance on Film Sociology.
Now that you've been released from the clutches of
Intercom Radio. My 1 year contract to always say nice things is now over.
Oh, that is part of the club. So let him tell you something.
Let me tell you something.
We're doing this show live from the front stoop.
Well, I tell you, those kids. Goyas, I tell you.
that movie ain't nothing. We saw that movie in 1964.
Yeah. Well, I never know.
So we're on the front stoop while Kobe's over there playing stickball.
That's right. Turn that noise down. It's a neighborhood. This ain't no residential district.
I know what they sampled. I own the album. Vinyl. Record. So,
By the way, I thought of you last night, flipping channels, and Under the Cherry Moon was on.
Ooh, you want to know one of the scariest film credits in the history of cinema? Directed by Prince.
And it took me just 5 minutes to realize to remember how horrible that movie was.
Yes, that shows you how much money Purple Rain made for Warner Brothers, that they thought, okay, we'll give Prince a second film and we'll let him star and direct in it.
And it'll be a poor man from Minnesota's Casablanca.
The problem is he thought it was White House.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, no, this ain't gonna be nothing like Casablanca. You got that right.
There's only two things that are semi-redeeming about that. Jerome, of course, who's always fun. And you get to hear Kirsten Scott Thomas find out where you buy a Sam Cooke album.
Rekisto. That Whoa! Was it.
But that's one joke, one laugh. I have a friend, my buddy Phil owns that film. And there's also, I remember punk, and Prince calling a girl Cabbage Head.
Yeah.
Three bits.
What's the one line that, you know, this gets almost sort of becomes a cliche in film critic world? You know, Purple Rain was a groundbreaking piece of cinematic literature with avant-garde music that just really made you blah, blah, blah. Under the Cherry Moon was 94 minutes long.
That's your bit.
Yeah, exactly.
So Abdul's hanging out with us today, and so just a few notes. Opening in theaters today, we have the latest Bourne film, only Matt Damon's turned into Jeremy Renner, and it's a different director. Tony Gilroy is taking care of that. Also in theaters, The Campaign. Gee, it's an election year, so there's a comedy about two politicians. And then by Zach Galifianakis and Will Ferrell.
Yeah, I always get a little... Sometimes I found with political movies, either they're done, particularly political comedy movies, they're either done very, very, very well, like a Dave.
Dave, correct.
Or you get Jack Lemmon and...
My Fellow Americans. With James Garner. I remember that. There's The Distinguished Gentleman with Eddie Murphy. Man of the Year with Robin Williams.
Yeah. And then, but always for every American president, there's a Man of the Year.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah. And see, American President, that movie was awesome.
It was. I think it was labeled the liberal fairy tale, to which Rob Reiner and Michael Douglas said, so?
And no man. Hillary. That's...
No.
That was one of the other things that people talked about. It was why they left the... They were mad at the whole Hillary thing in the late 90s. That's why they sort of wrote her out of the script.
Yeah. It's dead. You're the president's girlfriend.
Yeah, but I love Primary Colors, though.
You do like Primary Colors.
I love that movie.
He's so not Bill Clinton. No, not at all. Nope, no. See, his wife's English. See, that's how we know. And Billy Bob Thornton is Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah, I'm a female lesbian. I do not fantasize about the male genitalia.
It's Kathy Bates, ladies and gentlemen.
Actually, she's more manly than I am.
Hey, now, she will knock you out.
Yeah, or break your feet.
And that's right.
Leave you in bed.
That's something we should look up is political films in an election year.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, some Planet of the Apes, 1968.
Wow, let's move on before you get in trouble. Wow. All right. So that's opening. But also opening, this opened Wednesday because I got a feeling they wanted to get an early head start before the comedy and the action movies really take over the box office for the weekend. But it's the romantic comedy Hope Springs. And it's from the director of The Devil Wears Prada, Easy Gents. And it's with Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones and Steve Carell. Jones and Streep play a couple who have been married for over 30 years. They're now empty nesters, and their marriage is in a serious rut. And I think the rest of the audio will explain the rest.
Happy anniversary.
They are so beautiful. Oh, Arnold.
Mm-hmm. So what did you guys get each other?
Yeah, 31. What gift is that? Silver, ivory?
Oh, we got each other the new cable subscription.
Oh, great.
It's a lot of channels.
If you're wondering...
It feels like Arnold and I aren't going towards anything anymore. I want a real marriage again.
I think for that to happen, we'd have to risk everything just to shake things up.
It's not impossible, and it's not too late.
Well, you want to go to intensive couples counseling in Maine?
The flight leaves tomorrow. I'm going to be on it.
I hope you're happy.
Hey, and Arnold, I'm so glad you're here.
Well, that makes one of us.
You two have come here to try to restore intimacy to your marriage.
This is insane. We're not 22 years old anymore.
I would like to assign you your first exercise. Tonight, I would like you to spend a period of time with your arms around one another.
I think we better stop.
I'm going to ask you to take a leap of faith and try something.
I'm looking for sex tips for a straight woman from a gay man.
It's most likely way out of your comfort zone.
I'm just not... That's not me. I just can't do that.
You come up here, you spend 1 week, and you're supposed to have a new marriage?
Arnold, your wife is very unhappy. And you have to ask yourself, have I done all I could?
Trying to get the old magic back?
Join the club, honey.
Who in here is not having sex?
It's not too late for anyone who truly wants it and is willing to try.
I wonder if he talks to his wife like that. Mildred, I find it very interesting that you are naked. But you gotta keep your head up. We're doing so well, we might be able to get out of here early. Next step. What is it? Write a poem, hold hands in public, sing a serenade?
It's sex.
We should just get our things and go. Keep your head up. And you can let your head down.
Did you have fantasies?
The threesome?
With?
Carol.
Carol with the corgis?
Hi! You got another corgi!
I know! But three's the limit.
So we have a romantic comedy with two Academy Award winners, Tommy Lee Jones and Meryl Streep, and the review of this in Fresh Air, which they aired earlier this week, also made reference to the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel and the fact that you have two comedies with older actors. And they're tapping into that demographic because, you know, all the darn kids are going to see it. You know, they're not getting shot at the Dark Knight, and now they're going to go see the Bourne film and all that. So the fact that you have a mature actors and a mature subject matter, this is not – I know Meryl Streep's done this before. She did It's Complicated with Alec Baldwin, and those are Nancy Meyer films. That's the woman who gave us It's Complicated and Something's Got to Give, you know, which also revitalized Diane Keaton's career. And those are films in which they're silly romantic comedies with mature actors.
These are my mother-in-law's movies.
Kind of like that. So, and what I'll say is, films like It's Complicated and Something's Got to Give, even though it does have older characters, older actors, but they are kind of the standard romantic comedy situations.
Yeah.
You could see Kate Hudson doing a younger version of It's Complicated or...
But it was interesting seeing Steve Martin basically play the straight man.
Right. But this is different. Kate Hudson cannot do Hope Springs. This is, a couple that have been together for 30 years. And the lovely Miss Associe and I got to see this. And what was fascinating was how... I didn't expect this, and you don't really get this in the trailer. I don't think you do. Is how far they go.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of. I mean, first off, yes, Steve Carell is in this, and you hear there's Elizabeth Shue, and there's in the trailer there's Mimi Rogers and Jean Smart. They're barely in the film, and you know the biggest thing that Steve Carell does in this film is get up out of his chair.
Uh-huh.
So I mean, he plays it straight.
He plays a straight therapist.
Yeah, as a straight therapist, and of course. I think everybody wanted to do this project to work with Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones. That's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I totally get that. But this is really the Tommy Lee Jones and Meryl Streep show with this couple. And the fact that they talk a lot, but they talk about subject matters that when you've been married for a while, yes, they do talk about fantasies. They do talk about what happens in the bedroom.
Yeah.
They talk about where the marriage went wrong. So there's if you've been in a relationship for a while, hopefully you have or you haven't, had those moments, and so it's almost like the quiet drive home.
Yeah,
and Jones and Streep are really strong in this. Jones finally lightens up near the end because we've seen Tommy Lee Jones as the Rock of Gibraltar and chasing Harrison Ford and all that,
and also in
everything
Men in Black.
And he turns into a Josh Brolin all of a sudden.
George W. Bush.
Right, But this is the first time I can remember where I've seen Tommy Lee Jones vulnerable, which actually winds up happening in the last third of the picture. But it's interesting how
I think he had a little bit of vulnerability in No Country for Old Men.
That's true. No, I'll give you that.
Yeah, sort of at the end when he just sort of
that
seems,
great speech.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd say there's more of a. There's more physical, emotional vulnerability in this one. Yes,
yeah.
But there is times at the beginning where he is. At times, really insufferable, and this is a marriage that's in a rut because I think everybody else would have probably left him for being with the short answers and Kurt, and you're surprised he doesn't lean over and punch Steve Carell in the face. The other part is, there are these humorous moments with the exercises that the therapist gives out, and you wind up seeing not physically more of Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones than probably anybody would ever imagine, but. The things that they try to do, you didn't think you'd see this from either one of them.
Yeah, it's like watching your parents.
Kind of like watching your parents if mom and dad have four Oscars between them. But there's
no Justin Abdul, Jamila, no more.
I will say, and it's not really giving away anything, but there is a scene involving Meryl Streep, Tommy Lee Jones, and a movie theater.
Hmm.
So,
alrighty then.
But the fact is, they went there, and the fact that they, like I said, if you've been in a relationship for a long time, you will hopefully relate to this. pretty strong performances, even though Jones's character is a little more one. He's the grumpy, short answer husband.
My gun.
Yeah, right. but my inspiration when Emma starts dating.
Yeah.
So yeah, go see it for them. You know, the lines are going to be full for the campaign and Bourne. So, but.
There really isn't a whole lot else.
No,
out there right
no.
Now.
I mean, if people want to see Dark Knight for the fifth time, but the other thing that the Fresh Air review brought up is because we asked HW if she wanted to go because she likes Meryl Streep and she likes Steve Carell, but I'm curious to see if younger audiences go to this and if they're going to get icked out because old people are kissing.
You see, but I don't think this was.
It's not made for them.
Yeah, it's not made for them. Right. So.
Just like Adam Sandler movies aren't made for us.
Right. Because we walk upright and have opposable thumbs.
That's right. We lift our hands when we're walking.
Yeah.
So anyway.
We don't have jaws fit for grazing.
It turned out to be much more than the trailer shows you. And it was from a personal level, as somebody who's been married for over a dozen years, it's it really kind of resonated in a good way. So
now that was a good movie.
Now let's have Ben Kingsley. I like that. I actually like it that much.
Yes, 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 yes.
See, and if Sir Ben doesn't like a movie, do you have that?
No, 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 no.
We also have one of my personal favorites.
Wow, that'd be some good filming there, Mr. Soci.
And things that will keep us off off of HD1.
Yeah, exactly.
So
that'll
you know what?
Explain it.
We're gonna have a special guest in a little bit, but I want to talk to Abdul while he's here about a couple things. First off, Kevin Murphy, one of the members of Mystery Science Theater and 3000 and Riff Tracks. I got to talk to him earlier this week, and we'll play that in a little bit. But I brought Abdul here, besides the fact that it's the 1 year anniversary, and we're reunited, and it feels so good.
So good.
And no time has passed since we were on. You know what? If you see us on the street, we kind of do this. So I think we should probably just pass the hat around if we see each other.
Exactly.
We should go have dinner and just have a. Can McCormick's, can we do that? Can we get the tip jar if we go have dinner at McCormick's?
I think we probably can.
I think we should.
Skip that. We're making the Columbia Club.
Ooh, there
really,
we go.
Really have some people talking.
Look out, Columbia Club. But,
take away my cigar smoking. Okay.
Well, so there's a couple of films that I watched recently. And one was because of an article in The Onion. If you go to The Onion's AV Club, there's a very good article, a very interesting one, and it asked the question, did 12 Angry Men get it wrong? And it's funny because I bought this on Blu-ray when it came out, the week it came out. It was probably a couple months ago, and hadn't gotten around to watching it. So then when I saw this article, decided to read it. Printed it out, looked at it, studying a little bit, and watched the film again this week. And I asked you, Mr. Shabazz, to watch this since you're also, I think you're legal counsel for film sociology because we're sure as hell going to need it.
Yeah.
But anyway, your thoughts on this. I highlighted a couple of areas.
Well, the main thing was anyone who's ever seen 12 Angry Men knows they all start out with the, you know, with except for Peter Fonda, thinking the boy's guilty.
Henry Fonda.
Henry Fonda, yeah.
It'd be interesting if, five-year-old
yeah, five-year-old
Peter
Fonda. Yeah. And Henry Fonda basically convincing them through various means, one at a time, that the boy's not guilty. And so what the Onion article does is they walk through sort of like the three or four major points that they kind of argue and debate over that eventually
leads
to the turnaround. My thing is, I see where the article is coming from because they're basically saying, did 12 Angry Men get it wrong? And did they let a guilty person go free?
And, of course, the comparison they make is O.J.
O.J. Simpson. So. But one of the lines in the movie is when Henry Fonda's in the bathroom and he's talking to the guy who's the painter, says, you know, I'm convinced you've never been more wrong in your entire life, and, you know, have you ever thought about what if he's guilty? And they kind of leave that little bit of a moment sort of hanging there. What I would argue is that if I was on the jury, I couldn't have convicted him, maybe not for all those reasons, but at least there's one of those reasons that gave me some doubt. One of which is when he talks to E.G. Marshall, by the way, the president in Superman 2, which was on yesterday.
It's also on The Doctor, but anyway.
Yeah.
And cockroach bait and Creepshow.
Yeah. When he talked about, you know, the woman had the glasses on, but she was able to see at night 30 feet away without glasses. I mean, that would have did it for me.
And that's what turned around E.G. Marshall.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I thought that, maybe if you line up all these things together, but if you're on the jury, one of them is really all you need, you know.
Right. So they bring up that aspect, and one of the things, yeah, they said the most satisfying turnaround was that with the E.G. Marshall character. And then what ensures the kid's guilt for practical purposes, though neither the prosecutor nor any of the jurors even mentions it. And Rose, apparently, this is a screenwriter, I never considered it, is the sheer improbability that all the evidence is erroneous. And something that's brought up in the article is, of course, when Henry Fonda brings out the duplicate switchblade, he could have easily been chucked out of, they could have been called a mistrial,
I believe. But actually, I would argue we don't know that because we look at, and this is where I get all lawyerly, so please forgive me.
That's all right.
Yeah, I mean, this is 1959. I have no idea what the rules of evidence were.
Okay.
And the place where they were, because nowadays, you know, jurors aren't supposed to go out and do their own investigating.
Right, and that's the big thing on this.
Detective work. So I'm like, well, this is also like 50 years ago. We got, you know, we didn't even read people Miranda rights back then. I mean.
Right.
So.
But it, and it says, and the response is, there's no reason offered in 12 Angry Men for why, say, the police would be planting switchblades compared to the O.J. trial.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's another thing about that. And then, of course, it ends the article with, the kid is almost certainly guilty. What a hell of a downbeat, realistic twist ending that would be, huh? Had the movie been made during the Watergate era, that's probably how it would have turned out. It'd been like the Parallax View.
Yeah, exactly. He's guilty. He did it.
So, anyway, 12 Angry Men, it's out on Blu-ray, and it's Sidney Lumet's first film as a director. And, yeah, let's see, I used to know all 12, but I know. Henry Fonda, Lee J. Cobb, E.G. Marshall, Jack Klugman, John Fiedler, Piglet, for you fans out there, Harry Carey Sr., Jack Warden, Robert Weber, Jack Klugman, the old guy, the Brooklyn guy, and the Euro guy.
And see, here's how I know them. The guy from the spaceship episode of The Twilight Zone, the guy who played the librarian in Star Trek.
Keep going.
I remember them all from Twilight Zone.
Norman Thayer Jr.
Yeah, exactly. Oscar Madison, you know, Ed Begley's dad, who was just beyond Mork and Mindy, you know. That's how I remember these guys. And see, but I also, because I teach speech over at Ivy Tech, I show this film every semester to my students.
Didn't you say it should be required viewing?
Yeah, and I always tell them, okay, this movie's a little bit older, so some of you guys may not be familiar with, but any of you who've ever watched the old episodes of Twilight Zone, you'll see a lot of these people who were in the Twilight Zone because they were the actors of there.
Right, and these were, I mean, you, Henry Fonda was the big name, and yeah. He was a producer on it, so everybody else were these New York stage actors whose careers were just starting.
Yeah.
So.
Because Lee J. Cobb was also like in a bunch of like 70s cop type shows.
70s cop type shows. He was also not the original, but in the 60s revival of Death of a Salesman with Willie Loman. Quite good from what I was seeing in the clips. And, of course, on the waterfront and those pictures. So that was up. And now we have we're going to do one half of the double shot. We have a series here at Film Sociology that I like to tap into every now and then called Into the Archive. And this is where studios like Warner Brothers, Sony, MGM, they have the movies that you can order online only. You can't get them in stores. Or, as Kobe likes to put it,
yeah, I'll burn it for like $5.
Yeah. Only Warner Brothers is burning it for $20.
Yeah.
And one of the films that was on my list, and of course I knew you were going to be here, was the late 90s cable remake of Inherit the Wind. Now I'm gonna defend it a little bit.
Okay.
This is the one. Now, the original film was Spencer Tracy. Frederick March and Gene Kelly as Abdul, and you also had
the one who dances.
He was E.K. Hornbeck. Yeah, he's strutting in the rain,
Grandpa. Which, by the way, not to interrupt you, but when I did the stage play,
you had that moment.
I had the moment.
An African American holding the monkey.
Here I am as the only African American in the whole play. I'm the, you know, big city reporter. I come to the small town
from Baltimore.
From
appropriately
Baltimore.
Enough.
Yeah, exactly. South side of Baltimore.
Hi, Rock.
Yeah, I grab the little stuffed animal monkey. I hold him up and yell, "Grandpa!" And everybody just, "Oh my God, what just happened?"
You
here?
Just addressed the baboon in the room.
So I scratch my butt and, you know, throwing pieces at people
and chasing Charlton Heston. Or, oh, Joe Frazier?
Yeah.
No, that's what Ollie called him. Don't yell. Don't send hate mail to me. Yeah. So anyway, Gene Kelly was in that. You had Judge Harry Morgan. You had Dick York as the teacher. I mean, and Claude Akins was the preacher. So anyway,
great film.
Well, they did a remake. And it's funny. This is where it all comes down to. There was a 90s cable remake of 12 Angry Men.
George C. Scott.
And Jack Lemmon. And they did non-white people in that one. And it was directed by William Friedkin. Well, that went over so well they teamed up Lemon and George C. Scott again for Inherit the Wind. And Bo Bridges plays Hornbeck. And a lot of those guys from the last 20 years, 30 years, are the other characters. Yes, it's not the original. And I think Frederick March and Spencer Tracy, that's like a heavyweight championship match boxing.
Yeah, that's a Meryl Streep and
Philip Seymour Hoffman in Doubt. Yeah, that's a great bout. But to be fair, even though they were still really in the last 100 yards of their careers and lives, George C. Scott and Jack Lemmon have a lot of fun together working on this. And I think even though it's Cable and even though it's been remade, and I think the story is still one of the major stars of the show itself. Yeah. And when you have two or three, and Piper Laurie plays Matthew Brady's wife, when you have really good actors doing that material, it's fun to watch it regardless.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like when we saw 12 Angry Men.
With Richard Thomas.
Richard Thomas.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, if you have the right people, You can always do it well. I always get a little hesitant when people try to sort of remake and revamp. It's like,
sure. Now, like with 12 Angry Men, they brought in, Ozzie Davis, Edward James Olmos,
they got like
Danza,
12 Angry People.
12 Angry People. There have been those.
Of course, my personal favorite is Robot Chicken, 12 Angry Little People.
Yeah, that's a lot of Peter Dinklage.
You ever seen that bit?
No.
Oh, my gosh.
I'll find it.
Yeah. Why does every time a black man got to be on TV, he got to be a positive role model?
Oh, wow, yeah. Man. There was also a TV movie version of Inherit the Wind in the 80s. Because I remember having to read excerpts from it in high school, but it was Kirk Douglas. It was Brady.
Yeah.
Jason Robards was Drummond. And Darren McGavin was your role. Yes, the old man from Christmas Story. Really? Or the Night Stalker. Huh. So, and I don't think that's
Kolchak?
Yeah, Kolchak. I don't think that's ever not the guy in Watchmen. Not the best part of Watchmen.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't think that's out on DVD or Blu-ray. It probably should be, because I'd be intrigued to watch.
I thought I actually did see that like on DVD, like at Hollywood Video, and the lovely Mrs. Shabazz was dragging me to hell.
Not the Wes Craven movie or Sam Raimi movie.
Was that too? I think that's what she picked up.
Oh,
I hate video stores.
Well, I guess we're just going to skip the video store then, and we're going to take a short break, and we're going to get to my chat with Kevin Murphy of Mystery Science Theater and Riff Tracks fame. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org.
Your opinion, man.
Opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one.
Hi, Abdul.
So was Abdul.
Speaking of which.
Opinions, that is.
Yes. It'd be a freaking nature if you had the other.
Well, I am an attorney.
Yes. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point, WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoci@WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Soci. Hanging out with Abdul Hakim Shabazz and Kobe Slagle. And it was special extra geeky this week here at Film Sociology. Oh my god! Not since Abdul and I talked to Svengoolie about a month or so back that have I been this. I'm like most 98% of college men.
Stoked.
I was stoked about this interview. I got to speak with Kevin Murphy. You know him as the voice of Tom Servo from Mystery Science Theater 3000. And Riff Trax, and he's of course one third of Riff Trax, along with Mike Nelson and Bill Corbett, and they have a live performance of the movie Manos: The Hands of Fate. And Kobe, do we have where that's going to be performed in Indianapolis?
Yes.
That's next Thursday, I believe.
Let's see. In Indianapolis, we are at AMC Castleton, AMC Showplace 17. I think that's Glendale.
I believe.
Yes, and then Galaxy 14 on 96th Street.
And that's at 8 o'clock. Is it 8 or 7?
Wow.
Might need to go to Fathom.
Get there at 7.
Yeah, get there at 7. Have the popcorn. But anyway, you go to Fathom's website or you check out the times of those movie theaters that we just mentioned.
Hamilton 16, IMAX, and Noblesville.
Oh,
also.
That's Gina's theater.
Yes, that is.
Yeah,
that
she gets to do her her OCD popcorn moments. Yeah. So we love you, Gina. And so anyway, here we go. My chat with Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater and Riff Trax. Joining me on Film Sociology is a man whose work is now part of the Soci household. Just so you know, Kevin, in my house we say things like, "Oh, do you dare?" and "Movie bad, movie go away." Kevin Murphy of Riff Trax, how are you?
I am just fine, Matt. How are you?
Doing great, doing great.
Good.
Like I said, my daughter is 10. She's the kids' film correspondent, and she wanted me to tell you she cannot decide which film is worse, the worst film that she's ever watched, Manos or The Room.
Ooh.
So thank you for that.
Oh, you're most welcome. And yeah, I would put Manos up there, or down there below The Room, only because you can actually see and hear all of The Room.
Well, if as much as you can understand Tommy Wiseau.
That's true.
So for those who don't know, tell us about Manos: The Hands of Fate, the greatest movie ever shot in El Paso.
That's for sure. And as far as I know, you know, there's a lot of legends running around, but essentially it was originally made by a fertilizer salesman from El Paso who sort of did it on a bet, saying that he could actually make a film. And he did, having absolutely no experience or talent at it. And I think he was very proud of the fact that he actually made the film. It didn't make any difference to him whether it was good or bad. And it's a story about a family who is driving and gets lost in the West Texas desert and comes across we're supposed to think eventually that it's like a semi-mythical place where a fellow who looks a little bit like Zach Galifianakis with giant knees lives with a tall fellow who looks like Jeff Foxworthy in a muumuu.
Now, and of course, the parent, especially the dad, makes decisions that even horror movie teenagers say, don't do it.
Yeah, bad choices. He endangers his child constantly. He immediately trusts the evil goat-footed man, and he lets the family dog get killed. I'm sorry, these are spoilers, aren't they?
No, from a 50-year-old film, right. And you know what? They're also made out of people, so it's okay.
Right, yes.
It's all right. Now, I know if I remember in some interviews, some of the group from MST has referred to this as the worst film you guys ever showed. Is there a list?
I don't know. You know, it was different for different people. And worst is, you know, it is a subjective thing. It wasn't one of the hardest films we went through. It was hard. It was really hard. Maybe it was, but it wasn't the hardest film that we actually had to riff. I always give that over to either The Robot versus the Aztec Mummy, which is, I believe, the only time that we ever pulled out a bottle of tequila to help ourselves through the writing session. Personally, Red Zone Cuba was much more grim and desperate and sad and soul-sucking for me than Manos was. Although my soul was thoroughly sucked out by Manos, Red Zone Cuba was worse for me.
That was the other title I was thinking of in that case. So
yeah.
So now Riff Trax is going to revisit Manos. Why would you do this?
That is an excellent question. Why would Evel Knievel try to jump over the Snake River Canyon twice? Because he's an idiot? Okay, that's what I'm saying. No, it seemed like the appropriate time. You know, next year, Mystery Science Theater will be 25 years old from its very first shows. And And it's the film that when we've asked people, what would you like to see us do live, Manos keeps coming back. It just kept coming back. So sort of people were demanding Manos. It's a film that our fans, who were Mystery Science Theater fans, I think it's the one they recall the most because it is so exquisitely painful and bad. But for them, it sort of sums up what the whole riffing world is about. So it just seemed appropriate. And we've got two young, very funny writers along with Mike, Bill, and I, Sean Thomason and Connor LaStoca. And they're bringing a fresh perspective to this thing. And so we're really taking it back down. I haven't seen the film in truly over 10 years until just in the last couple of months. And so the old wounds had all closed up, and now they're all open again, and except I have a brand-new perspective on it. I think it'll be if you can even say that in regards to Manos, it'll be a fresh take on Manos.
Well, I wondered if how much was going to be new material or old. First thing I thought of were rock bands and jazz bands that now tour and perform an entire album in its entirety, and I wasn't sure if you three were going to just do the original riffs from the first time.
No, that'd be too easy. And I think people, you know, when we've done our live show, we did Plan 9 from Outer Space, which was one of our more popular live shows. We rewrote the script for that so that it'd be fresh even from our own riff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not Mystery Science Theater anymore. We're Riff Tracks, so we sort of have to do it in our own way. And not perform the album, as it were.
Well, it's funny. We got to see the Plan 9, and it was fun hearing my daughter go, daytime, nighttime, Bella, not Bella.
Oh, fun.
So where are you guys performing the film itself?
We will be at the Belcourt Theater in Nashville, Tennessee, which is a great old proscenium sort of theater. It's been a venue for a lot of rock and roll acts as well as a movie theater. And so, you know, it's a little bit frumpy, but it's, you know, it also has its great charms. It's very intimate. So it's a perfect place for us to do it. And because of that, when we beam it out nationwide to, I think it's about 550 theaters, then it keeps that intimacy because it looks like, you know, you're in the theater and you're watching us in this little theater in front of a crowd of just a few hundred people. It just makes it feel, it gives that live experience that much more connection. The audience gets more connection to us because we're really connected to that audience in Nashville.
You mean you couldn't find a theater in El Paso to do this?
You know, I was afraid that if we do it in the hometown, that they're going to run us out on a rail.
Well, there is something to be said because also on the show this week, I was talking about a couple films from the 70s, and it's great to see films that are not in Hollywood or New York. I just watched the 70s zombie film Sugar Hill. Which was filmed in Houston, and then you have a film like Blackenstein, which I believe was shot in Louisville, Kentucky.
That would make sense. Yes, indeed.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So what is going on with Riff Tracks besides Manos?
Well, we continue to do riffs of big Hollywood films, but we've also been concentrating lately on doing some, you know, cheesy older films, sort of like we used to do on Mystery Science Theater, because again, people have been asking for us to do that. So, just recently we have a film called Neutron versus the Death Robots, which is a Mexican wrestler hero film.
Yes.
So that's a lot of fun. We're doing films sort of that ilk. We just recently did Future Cop, which features David Carradine with his, you know, big beer gut sleeping his way through the lines. And it's the future, only it's like a 70s version of the 80s, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think of the costumes in Logan's Run.
Right. Oh, they're worse here. Yeah. You know, they just sort of took, you know, for their future-y cars, he drives a Jeep Commando.
Ah, well, of course. who knew that car was so far in advance?
Nothing changed on it whatsoever, and yet it is future for us.
Now, are you guys able to pick old film, new film? Is there a pattern, or does it just go with how you guys are feeling?
Well, it kind of goes with what is either available or popular, because what we found is that we'll pour our hearts out into a new release that we, you know, just do the MP3 riff for and then send it out there, and nobody's renting it, so there aren't that many copies available. So it makes it sort of silly if we're going to go to all the trouble to riff, you know, a 3.5 hour modern piece of junk that only 10 or 12 people rented. That's not very encouraging. So we've been sticking to really like the prime cuts these days, you know, your Twilights, your superhero action films. So, you know, they're going to get their due.
Yeah, I would say I think your versions of Twilight and The Room are probably some of the best and probably the most popular. Is Tommy Wiseau or Kristen Stewart become the new Joe Don Baker? Are they looking for you?
Haven't heard from Kristen. From what I understand, Tommy is sort of confused by what it is we're doing and thinks somehow we're actually stealing the movie.
Uh-oh.
So we had to disabuse him of that notion because we're not. We're just helping him along. If anything, we're selling more units of The Room.
And that's what lawyers are for, so they have to listen to him.
Right.
Now, is the viewing time of Riff Track similar to Mr. Science Theater? Like, how many times do you watch a film before you actually riff it?
Well, it's a little different from what we used to do at Mystery Science Theater in that we don't do everything out of a writing room. What we do these days is, since there's five of us, we sort of divide the film up into five parts, and we each take a chunk and just sit and look at it for, sometimes a week at a time, depending on the film, because it takes at least an hour of writing time to deliver a minute of script, sometimes more. So you spend a whole lot of time with a chunk of the film, and then when it comes together, I think we've become such a good unit that it's hard to tell one writer from the other. And we come together and we do a revision and we do a rehearsal and then we record it. And by the time we record it, we're so stinkingly familiar with the film that, you know, it's very easy to perform.
And how long do you decompress after a film like that?
Well, unless I have to, except for quality control purposes, I don't really revisit any of these films again for a good long time after I've watched them.
So do you cleanse your palate by watching a good movie?
Whenever I can, you know, that gets harder to do these days. So I go back and, my favorite medicine in the world is Turner Classic Movies.
Good call. Good call. I would say, and your book was a lot of fun, and you made me feel like a slacker, so I'm still trying to pick up on that.
I appreciate it. I'm encouraged. What I've heard recently, people who have followed me because of my book on either Facebook or Twitter have been tweeting me back that a lot of outdoor theaters and drive-in theaters are opening again. It's becoming a trend again, except they're having better food and the sound is better and they're making more of an event out of it in some places. So it's not sort of like the sleazy old place you remember. It's just, it's gotten a little bit classier. I don't know how to feel about that, but I still love going to a drive-in and seeing a movie.
Absolutely. There's I think, one in Indiana still. But, I think of the architectural theaters that were gloriously downtown venues, and then they turned into porn houses in the 60s and 70s, and now they're trying to revitalize downtowns.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's one way to do it. It's, people will never stop going to the movies, and as long as they can make some money, I'm a big supporter of single-screen theaters that show whatever it is they think they should show, be that a repertoire or just things that they handpick, that they're not forced down them by the distributors. I encourage that.
Absolutely. And we also have an unnamed art house chain here in Indy, and they did midnight movies this summer, and they're doing it again in the fall, including The Room and Troll 2.
Wonderful.
So how often do you get to watch movies at home with the family on your own?
We do it quite often, actually, thanks to things like Netflix and Vudu and such outlets. There's a lot of good stuff out there. And then, of course, Turner Classic Movies, which is one of those destinations I go to. I will flick it on. I'll see something that maybe I've never seen before, and I'll find myself up until 2 in the morning watching something from, 1936 or a silent series or something like that.
Or non-Frankie and Annette Beach movies.
Right. Oh, yes. Dear Lord.
Now, I'm not saying you riff at home, but do you mutter and just out of habit?
Only if something's really bad. And then, my governor goes off, and then I peg the needle and I fly off the handle. And then usually Jane, my spouse, says, let's change the channel. Let's go play Scrabble. Or let's do something besides listen to you tear into something I like.
Can you give us an example of a film recently?
I actually am more inclined to do this with things like House Hunters.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Now, do you? Oh, so go ahead.
Oh no, and Jane's tastes trend more towards, you know, chick films.
Okay.
So if it's something sort of a goopy chick film on there, I'll start getting snide, and then she'll smack me down.
We kind of do that with Food Network and HGTV.
It's so easy.
Yeah, and anytime you can make House Hunter seem like gambling in the house.
Yeah.
So do you remember the first film? I mean, I'm talking about way before Mystery Science Theater, that you ever riffed in a theater or started to think about snide comments as a kid or even as a young adult?
Actually, the first time I found myself actually in a theater making fun of a film, my brother Christopher and I think it was, went to see this really bad film with Marlon Brando and George C. Scott called The Formula.
Yes, yeah.
It was supposed to be this big potboiler, and we were about halfway through, and we started just riffing on the film with each other. And it was like a midweek thing. I think we were both working in restaurants, and so we had the days off, and went to see this film in a theater, and there was nobody else there, so it was perfect.
I just found that for $2 at a bookstore, so you could watch Marlon Brando with an earpiece.
That's right.
Because there was that, and there was, if you remember, Reflections in a Golden Eye that he did with Elizabeth Taylor and a naked, naked Robert Forrester, which Mrs. Forrester didn't even ask for. So do you guys have Christmas and Halloween all planned out for Riff Tracks?
We do not. I know it's been announced that sometime around Halloween. I don't have the dates with me. You might want to check with the Riff Tracks people, you know, the guys who actually know stuff.
Yeah.
That we are going to Riff Birdemic, Shock and Terror.
Wow. Of course.
For Fathom Entertainment.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So
that'll be a lot of fun.
And people can go to Riff Tracks website and check that out.
Go to rifftracks.com and check it out.
You on Twitter or are you just on Facebook?
I'm mainly on Twitter. Facebook gives me hives.
I'm sorry to hear that. Like Manos hives?
Hives, yes. I love the Twitter because it makes me keep it short, and I'm much better when I'm doing short stuff instead of prattling on.
No political diatribes? No.
No. I stay away from the politics. No, I make jokes about, my love of meat. I think that's about as political as I get. I'd be a vegetarian as long as I could first eat all the ducks in the world.
Wow, there's some right-wing vegans that are going to come after you. It's like the punk band we have here in Indianapolis, Gay Black Republican.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That's Kevin Murphy of Riff Tracks and Mystery Science Theater 3000. He's going to be riffing next week, Manos, The Hands of Fate. And so you can go to Riff Tracks, or actually go to Fathom.com for times and screenings, I believe.
Finally said, something on Fathom that'll be in English?
Oh, you mean not an opera?
Yeah. Or Glenn Beck's crazy rants.
Yes. So that's the...
something that'll be in English.
Yes, that's true. Something's going to be... And, of course, what I call the gold coins of film sociology is when you get something like this.
This is Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Riff Tracks. And in case you didn't know it, and you probably should, you are listening to Film Sociology on WFYI.
It's the little things that make me happy.
Nice.
Now, Abdul-Hakim Shabazz is still hanging out with me, and we have, as I said before, we have a double shot of Into the Archives, and this is a first in the history of film sociology and the segment Into the Archives. Again, these are movies that you order from the studios online, and they basically burn you a disc, and they send it to you. Now, these movies also apparently show up on cable from time to time, and this was, again, a movie I bought, and it's been on the pile, and I have not watched it yet, although I've seen this particular movie, as I did Inherit the Wind when I knew Abdul was going to be here. But Abdul called me because he calls me, I'm his film concierge 24/7.
That's
right.
I get
calls and texts at all hours of the day and night when he's watched something. It's like, it's almost, as we say, Dr. Soce, film therapist. Have you seen this piece of crap? What is this movie? Why am I watching this movie? Why does this movie get made? How come you're not watching it? You know, that sort of thing. But we found something that we watched almost together. One day, and this is a film I think I need to watch with your dad.
Yeah.
Along with the John Wayne movie. but no, this is a film from 1974. It's not the same. It's the same title as a so-so Wesley Snipes crime thriller. No, this is far, far more entertaining. Here's the trailer to 1974's Sugar Hill.
Blood is red. Voodoo is blue. Sugar is sweet. Revenge is sweeter.
I'm passing seconds.
Meet Sugar Hill.
No, please.
Not a place. But a brand new face.
My friends call me Sugar.
The foxiest.
Looking for anything special?
Sexiest. Deadliest chick in town. The mob took Sugar's man away. And now, she's gonna make them pay.
I want them dead.
With a voodoo priestess called Mama Matrace.
I know what you can do. The power you possess.
How strong is your hate?
And Baron Samedi, too.
My particular special. A drink that I'm famous for. The zombie.
This is my domain. A kingdom of the dead.
And an army of undead behind her.
Each death has had something to do with voodoo ritual.
There's nothing that Sugar can't do.
Use it.
The mob has never seen anything like Sugar Hill and her zombie hitmen.
From 1974, shot in Houston, Texas, Sugar Hill.
As the critic said on Amazon.com, if I had not seen it with my own eyes, I would not have believed it.
But you see, I do believe it because of my fascination with black cinema of the 1970s. Of course, in 1972, Blackula became, it was one of the first non-black action films. You know, they had to give some, you know, Jim Brown and Fred Williamson needed a rest.
So they brought in William Marshall. Shakespearean trained actor.
And this is kind of what he's known for, although he's great as Othello. If you ever see his Othello on DVD, it's
And Dr. Daystrom on Star Trek.
Very good. So with the success of Blackula, they started to really tap into the market. There, and I'm not making these up. There is Blackenstein, Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde, Abby, which was also labeled The Black Exorcist.
And Rosie Grier and Raymond Lamb.
Well, The Thing with Two Heads, J.D.'s Revenge, and now we had Sugar Hill, which they had a woman, actress from the 70s, apparently cheaper to pay than Pam Grier, who, gets back at a mobster who kills her husband, her fiancé, who, by the way, runs a Haitian-themed nightclub in Houston.
The Voodoo Lounge.
Because at the Club Haiti. But at the beginning, of course, you hear the song by a Motown group from the 70s, and there are shirtless African-American men with paint on their faces dancing with snakes. And this kind of, I was thinking about the actors who had the
Reminds me of home.
You're embracing your roots. But I kept thinking of, the only thing missing were the plate lips
Lady.
And the bone through the nose.
And Mira Makeba.
And the spirit, yeah. And yeah, I was thinking of like all the cannibal movies in the 1940s. Right, exactly. So like, and you're like, is this a voodoo ritual? Oh, even better. These are dancers at a Haitian nightclub in Haiti, or in Houston. So,
and then what made life even easier, and I don't think we're spoiling the ending.
No, I'm afraid not.
She goes through the thing where she gets the different voodoo, the mob guys, and kills all the
one by one,
and
yeah, very different ways.
Yeah, different ways. Then they kill the big boss, you know, voodoo big boss guy.
Yeah.
Then at the very end, it's her and Mother Jefferson, and
yeah, Zerika. We'll get to her in a minute. And Papa, I call him Papa Shango,
and Papa Doc Duvalier,
you know,
whoever the hell
the guy
he
with the top hat and the walking cane with
looks like somebody from an old 7-Up commercial.
But it's not that guy. It looks like him, but it's not. And believe it, or not, he has a shirt on under the suit jacket as opposed to being shirtless.
Yeah.
But right.
And then at the very end, he's like, you know, so what would you like to give me as payment?
And she thinks, hey, you know, we're not talking about her soul.
Yeah.
And of course, she
says, it's a tempting offer, but how about her?
I'm telling you,
he gives her the blonde white woman.
Of the mob boss.
Yeah. He gives the black voodoo devil guy the mob white woman girlfriend.
What do you think that's symbolic of?
Really?
And did you put down your novel copy of Mandingo?
Yes, I had to stop reading Malcolm X. I was like,
yeah. And by the way, there is a cat fight between Sugar Hill and White Mobster's girlfriend.
Yeah.
But yeah, the voodoo priestess is, if you are fans of television, Zara Cully, a.k.a. Mother Jefferson, who She was 86 when she died, which means she was working until she was 86. So she was probably, what, 82, playing the voodoo priestess to get, you know, to get Papa Shango.
This nightclub's got a lot of dust, Louise.
Yeah. She's being set up in heaven. You should have heard what Louise and St. George were saying about you, George.
George, someone's at the door. Tell them to go to hell. Okay.
Why we got to be in heaven with the Willises?
Mother Jefferson.
So anyway, she's in this, and it's just...
It's just so bad.
But it's entertaining. It's fun bad,
It's
I
Abraham
think.
Lincoln Vampire Hunter bad.
But cheaper.
But much cheaper. It's so bad, it's funny.
Now, you called it the best black horror film since Blackula.
Yeah. Pretty much.
I might have to watch the others.
That's like being valedictorian in summer school, too.
You're like school after Columbine. No class. Do we have time for dead people we like?
Yes,
speaking,
we do.
Speaking of the undead.
Hang on. Here we go.
Doing our the annual show of dead people we like.
There's a pretty big one this
week.
We don't have
time for dead people we don't like.
Yes.
Okay, yes, Hollywood obituaries, I guess, quickly, and so I know Abdul can recite lyrics from Marvin Hamlisch.
Mark Carpaggio! He sneezed on my Carpaggio!
Do not quote the one song from A Chorus Line. We can't do that one, but yes, The Way We Were, Starting Over, The Spy Who Loved Me. If you look at this guy's IMDb, you didn't do A Chorus Line, but you wanted, you did!
Yeah. Oh, I didn't. No, Marvin Hamlisch did.
Yes,
yeah.
I know, but I was like, I want to see you on a chorus line.
No, the only thing I could have done in a chorus line was play the Michael Douglas character.
The director, Zach. Because you don't dance. And I don't dance.
Don't sing either.
Genesis don't dance either. Oh, you sing.
Yeah.
You don't sing. You bellow.
That's right.
And your soul bellow all of a sudden. So Marvin Hamlisch, yeah, everything. My gosh, his first film was The Swimmer. And he also worked on two Woody Allen movies. He did the music for Bananas and Take the Money and Run.
Really?
But kind of like Frankie Lane. He played it straight.
Yeah.
Made it all the funnier. So
actually, I heard him on like Fresh Air. They replayed like an interview that
with
he did.
Him. Now, character actor, to talk about white that guy, R.G. Armstrong, died at 95. Probably best known he was Prune Face in Dick Tracy, the Warren Beatty. Was a regular of Warren Beatty's. He was in Heaven Can Wait. He was in Reds. A lot of westerns that your dad
owns. So it's just basically if Warren Beatty's in the movie, he probably is too.
More than likely. But
was he in Bullworth?
No. Not dark enough for Bullworth. Yeah. But he was in The Fugitive Kind. He was kind of one of the bad guys in Ride the High Country. He was a regular in Sam Peckinpah films, Major Dundee, El Dorado. He was Captain Dan in The Great White Hope, El Dorado, Battle of the Cable Hogue, J.W. Coop, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, White Lightning, the Italian western My Name is Nobody with Henry Fonda and Terrence Hill. Worked with Fred Williamson twice on Mean Johnny Barrows and Boss, or if you showed it in the North, it was just called Boss.
Wow.
Mr. Billion, The Car, Heaven Can Wait, Where the Buffalo Roam, Hammett, Lone Wolf McQuaid, Children of the Corn, the first one, sequels.
The Real Blue Man one?
Yeah, The Predator, he was General Phillips, Pruneface, and Payback, among others. So thank you for that. Longtime film critic Judith Crist, who was a writer with the New York Herald Tribune. So
another dead film critic.
Hey, that means I get to step up.
Yeah.
And
film critic number 6,842.
I'm going to get to the adult table by Thanksgiving, boys. There's going to be enough dead
Some's
adults.
Gotta give.
And we just got this today. Mel Stewart, not the guy who played George Jefferson's brother on All the Family, an actor, but the director who directed Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Which one?
The Gene Wilder one.
Okay.
Also did Watt Stacks, one of my favorite concert documentaries that was done in Los Angeles 1973 with Isaac Hayes, Albert King, the Staple Singers, Rufus Thomas. And in TV movies like Ruby and Oswald, The Triangle Factory Fire Scandal, Bill, the one with Mickey Rooney that got him a bunch of acclaim. One of his early films included If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Belgium, which is playing on cable somewhere right about now. So,
particularly If It's Tuesday.
Exactly. This is Belgium. So anyway, so Mel Stewart, but I, of course, the two big ones, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and for me, Watt Stacks. And by the way, as a tribute to Kevin Murphy, Em and I are still slugging through the castle of Fu Manchu with everyone's favorite Asian actor, Christopher Lee. Abdul, plug your website. It's been a year.
IndyPolitics.org. It's all the latest political news and information that you need to know about what's going on in Indianapolis, and plus with the election just 85 days away, it's a place you want to go.
And Gen Com's coming on the 16th through the 19th. GenCom.com. Here's some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Want to say to our friend Andrew, happy birthday. Boogada boogada. Dirka dirka. Abdul, thanks for hanging out.
Always a pleasure.
All right, so until next time, go see a good movie. You deserve it. Go see My Wife and Nonsense at Beef and Boards. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org.
Here we go. Good night, Fort Myers.